This is Central Time. College football has grown into much more than a rallying point for school spirit or extracurricular pastime.
Last year, the national championship drew a television crowd second only to the Super Bowl, and the average budget for a top 10 school is now $80 million a year.
College football may be a booming industry, but it's not without some consequences. Investigative journalists Jeff Benedict and Armin Katayan recently co-authored a comprehensive behind-the-scenes look at the college sport in their new book, It's the System: The Glory and Scandal of Big-Time College Football. Armin Katayan joins us now to discuss their findings. He's a CBS News correspondent based in New York, 11-time Emmy winner. Armin, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, my pleasure.
How did college football grow into such a big, popular, big-money game that it is today?
Well, I think if you had to point to one aspect of it, or two aspects of it, is, first of all, it's a tremendous spectacle, and it has great passion and loyalty among the fan base, and certainly Wisconsin would qualify in that category right at the top of the list. But I think the second thing, and probably the more important thing in the last 4 or 5 years, really has been the absolute infusion of multiples of millions and really billions of dollars into the game, primarily into the television contracts, both the national contracts that ESPN and Fox and CBS and ABC are signing, but I think even more importantly, ESPN's huge investment in the game, and particularly, you know, $600 million a year beginning next season to televise a series of postseason games, but primarily $413 million of that $600 for three games, the two semifinal games and the final game of the new national championship.
Well, in your book, you tell a lot of stories and you dig into a lot of scandals there. And reading through, I got an overarching picture, a feeling of pressure. All this money, the pressure from alumni to succeed at every level, the athletic directors, the NCAA as a whole, the coaches, the players, there's all this pressure. And it seems like it's just waiting for cracks and scandals to happen. Is that the feeling you get when you start digging into these stories?
I think that's a very good word, is that the thing that Jeff and I really tried to do was to kind of pull the curtain back on the mega programs and to give the average fan or the avid fan or the rabid fan a better idea of really all the machinery that goes into these mega programs and each aspect of it, where each chapter sort of takes one part of the system, which we always saw as a machine. And if you take each of those component parts, there's pressure within that component part. The pressure of an athletic director, like, say, David Brandon at the University of Michigan, to be able to generate $90 million a year to fund his entire athletic department, that $90 million coming from football. The pressure of under a college coach, let's say Mike Leach out at Washington State now, and what he has to do, or the university, which is making an enormous investment in not only Mike's $2 million a year salary, but an $80 million expansion of their stadium and their football facilities. The pressure that hostesses feel when they're recruiting these athletes, their place within the system. The pressure that tutors are under, and the relationships that they have with athletes, which, as we document in the book, the sexual tension and sometimes sexual assaults that result from this unusual relationship that a lot of tutors find themselves in with the athletes. So unquestionably, and then let me just to finish that, if there is one thing that came out of this book from my mind is the enormous pressure. If you think in terms of an inverted pyramid, the tip of that pyramid is placed right in the backs of 18 to 22-year-old kids. Because the entire pyramid, all the money, all the coaching salaries, all the branding that football is being used for by universities is placed right in the middle of the backs of these kids. And there's more pressure than ever on them to perform, and there's more pressure on them right now, I think, in the academic side of things and certainly on the athletic side of things.
Let's follow that thread with those student athletes. And you mentioned that the term is used often more derisively than otherwise. Let's start with playing injured. How much pressure is there for a coach to get that player to play hurt, regardless maybe of short and long-term risks?
I think one of the things that we did was, and Jeff and I wanted to do a lot of our own independent reporting, we documented through the use of other reporters who worked with us and researchers that last year in the top eight BCS conferences and the two major independents, meaning Notre Dame and BYU, that there were 282 season-ending injuries in big-time college football last year. That's a staggering number. And even more interestingly, 35% of those injuries, of those 282, happened this month, in the month of October, because you're at the end of a very difficult summer conditioning session, a very intense training camp. Then you start to play games, some of them lesser opponents, but now teams are moving into their conference play. So this weekend and then the next really four weekends, you're going to see far more injuries, I think, in college football than you'll see at any other time of the year. And that places pressure on the coaches to keep these kids in the lineup, because look what's already happened just in this first month of the season. Paul Pasqualoni of UConn was fired after four games, 0-4 start. Lane Kiffin was removed after losing seven of his last 11 games at USC. The pressure on these coaches is doing anything but decreasing. And that means that pressure filters down, just like that pyramid. That pressure filters down onto the backs of these kids. And the need for them to play, the star player to get on the field, to maybe ignore that injury he could use to take another week to recover and to go out and play on Saturday, because the win is so important to either stay in the hunt for a conference championship or for a national championship.
And what happens to the players who are injured and can't play anymore? They're off the TV. Where do they go then?
Well, I think that's one of the real sad parts of the system is that, you know, many of them are discarded. You know, these scholarships now are year to year. They're not 4-year grants. They're granted a scholarship or given a scholarship that's renewable year by year. So athletes who are injured, who are no longer of value to a football team, are often either told that they're no longer wanted and really it would be good for them to transfer, or if they're injured, they're given medical waivers so that that scholarship becomes available to the next recruit. So, you know, the system can be very cold-blooded. And one of the things we tried to do in the book, and I think we were very successful at it, is to get people who have lived inside this system and have been a part and parcel of it to speak on the record about their experiences. So whether it was a director of football operations at Texas who dubbed himself the janitor, or whether it was Lacey Pearl Earps, who was the hostess at Tennessee who got caught up in a scandal at Tennessee, or whether it's Teresa Brackle, who was a tutor at Missouri who got caught up in a sexual assault down there, or what it's like to go behind the scenes with Game Day and Chris Fowler and the people that put that together. We did not want to use unnamed sources, and we used very, very few of them, and I think that's one of the reasons this book has really captured people's attention and has received such strong reviews is that it's not Armin and Jeff telling you, it's people that Armin and Jeff interviewed, of which there were more than 500 people that we interviewed, outlining their experiences. And I think that's what makes this book unique.
We're talking to Armin Katayan. He's a CBS News correspondent, co-author of The System, The Glory and Scandal of College Football.
And now you can join in. Are you a fan of college football? Do you worry about the money involved and some of the issues that our guest is talking about right now? You can call us at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or send your email to talk@WPR.org.
This is Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferris.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back now with Armin Katayan, and we're talking about his new book, The System, The Glory and Scandal of College Football.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234, with your questions about college football, your worries about it, scandals you'd like to ask about, 800-642-1234. 1234. Armin, we'll get to calls in just a minute, but first, you mentioned a couple times the hostesses, and I want to get into that a little more. There's one of the pressures we talked about earlier is recruiting and trying to compete with your rivals and get the best players out of high school. Where do these hostesses fit into that effort?
Well, I think they fit in right at the front of the line, Rob. They're, you know, they're kind of the secret weapons of a lot of these schools, particularly in the South, in the SEC, and where you have 17 or 18-year-old boys being recruited and enticed by 21 and 22-year-old girls, principally over social media now. But actually, to back up, the hostesses are really the first face that a high school recruit will see when they come on campus. They're very pretty. They're smart. They've got terrific personalities, or they wouldn't be part of the hostess program. They know the school very well. And there's unquestionably, at times with the recruits and the hostesses, there is an intimation that, certainly a flirtation, but more so an intimation that if you come here, the possibility exists that we could have a relationship together. And then that is fostered, which is really a change in the last few years over the social media networks, Facebook or Skype, particularly Skype, where now in the case of the young woman that we profiled at Tennessee, she would be on Skype with some of these recruits, the top recruits, until 3 or 4 in the morning, talking about, you know, who knows what at that hour of the night. But they are absolutely critical. What was interesting in Lacey's case was she was nicknamed the closer at Tennessee because of her ability to get these top recruits to commit, one of them which was Bryce Brown, who was the top recruit in the country. Lacey told us that she never slept with one of these recruits, but she said unquestionably she would use, you know, the sexual tension and the intimation that the possibility existed that if they did come to the school, that relationship was possible. So it's kind of an unseen side of big-time college football, but it's an incredibly important side.
And this was at Tennessee. You said this is not the only school that does something like this.
Oh, no. I mean, you know, the SEC, whether it's the Bama Bells or the Orange Pride of Tennessee, or there's, you know, the same similar circumstances at Florida. You know, the Big Ten in cases have hostess programs. You know, they're across the Angels are at the University of Texas. It's across the country, and primarily, you know, in the mega programs where all things being equal, facilities, stadium size, coaching staff, academic centers, things of that nature. Let's face it, a 17-year-old boy, his many ways, his fantasy is having a relationship with a college girl. He comes there for the weekend. He's wined and dined, you know, and I'm putting quotes around that, but he's certainly made to feel very special. And one of the people that's doing that, the primary person that's doing that, is this beautiful college girl whose job is to make this kid feel like he's the greatest thing on the face of the earth. So, it's part and parcel of these programs. They're portrayed as tour guides and escorts, meaning they show the kids around campus. But in reality, and I think that's one of the really the best chapters of the book, is it's incredible insight into not only what Lacey was doing, but just as importantly, what happened to her once there was a investigation at Tennessee and her name popped up as part of a scandal. She was thrown under the bus by Lane Kiffin, who was then the head coach there. And that also tells you something about the system.
Let's go to the phones now. We've got Jeffrey on the line in Oshkosh. Jeffrey, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, good afternoon. I'm curious how often the misconduct or ethical lapses by top campus administrators who know of or approve of this misconduct, how often are they disciplined or terminated?
Well, I think that really depends on a couple of things. One is the NCAA's enforcement staff, which has been, frankly, on the run lately because of some situations that ethical breaches they found themselves in involving an investigation of the University of Miami. And I think, too, is how open is a university to investigating itself and getting to the bottom of potential scandal. And I think you find more often than not, athletic departments are willing to look the other way. Because let's face it, college football programs have become, you know, the face of a university. Unquestionably, I could name, and Wisconsin's at the, on that list as well. Mm-hmm. Alabama, I happen to be in Tuscaloosa right now working on a piece about Nick Saban. Nick Saban's effect at the University of Alabama has been extraordinary on the change of the student applications that are here. A much different student is now applying. 54% of their students are now from out of state, which has a tremendous impact on the bottom line of the university. They have taken the athletic department revenues from about $52 million to north of $90 million in the last couple of years. So these university football programs are no longer just football programs. They are the welcome mat or the front porch of a university. And I think Wisconsin certainly falls into that category. And when you have that at stake, how willing are you to look at the transgressions of people within the single most important department, in many cases, at a university? And that takes a strong-willed president to do something like that. And in the case of, you could look at Ohio State, you know, that university got caught up in a pretty big scandal because they believed their head coach when he said to them, you know, I know nothing about this Tattoo Gate scandal.
In our last minute or so, Armin, I want to ask you a general question. You've told a lot of stories, a lot that we won't even get to today. Do you think that college football is corrupting the mission of our universities and colleges around the country?
Wow. I don't know if it's corrupting it. It's certainly affecting it. I think you can no longer call these athletes student athletes. I think we show now that they're athlete students. They're spending more time in football-related activities, 41-plus hours a week, than they are in educational activities. So that's like 38 hours a week. When they become, you know, the brands of the university, you know, the mission gets skewed. And frankly, with all this money pouring in this national playoff on the horizon and all the problems that college football has had in the last even 6 months, I can't remember one college president who has stood up and said, look, this cannot continue. We have to do something to put this train, this runaway train, back on the tracks. And until they do that, I'm not really sure where this is headed. And I would argue that I don't think people like Mark Emmert at the NCAA or any of the other power brokers in this sport, whether it be Jim Delaney in the Big Ten or Mike Slive, the commissioner of the SEC, knows where it's headed.
Armin, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate it. That was Armin Katayan, CBS News correspondent, co-author of The System, The Glory and Scandal of College Football.